Support for Jazzed About Work comes from Ohio University's online master's degree in sustainability, security, and resilience. Does your organization or community have a workable plan for when a catastrophe strikes? This 18-month online degree program will give you the skills you need to prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural disasters and other crises. Participants earn 3 stackable certificates in community risk and resilience, change management and leadership, and planning resilient systems, leading to a full master's degree. Students learn cutting-edge skills in sustainability assessment and entrepreneurship, sustainable agriculture, energy policy, and more. This is an exciting, growing field, and no GRE test is required to apply. For more information, follow the link in the description on this podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Jazzed About Work, where we talk about everything that might have an impact on your career. I'm your host, Bev Jones. I'm an executive coach, and I write about career issues. Now, this is the second of 2 episodes in which we're talking about how stress can impact your career. When you're stressed out, you're not creative, you're not good at solving problems, and it's harder to get along with people. But the good news is that there are many ways to reduce stress. Our guest today is Gail Williams Byers. 2 years ago, after 11 years in her Ohio courtroom, she retired from her role as judge. Now, as a fellow with the National Judicial College, one of the things that she is doing is teaching judges, including teaching courses about how to deal with stress. Being a judge is very stressful, and stressed out judges don't make their best decisions. So, Judge Gail focuses on mindfulness and how it can calm our stress, enhance our decision-making, and change how we do our work and get through life. So here in this episode, Judge Gail will share her tips about specific ways you can manage your stress and at the same time support your well-being. Gail, thanks so much for coming back today.
Bev, I'm so happy to be back with you, and thank you for this opportunity to talk again. It's always enlightening.
Well, we got carried away last time when we talked about mindfulness and how you have used mindfulness as a way to help judges manage their very stressful jobs. But we never got to some of the details of, you know, the specific techniques that you use in your course for judges. So I'm so glad you're willing to come back, and we're going to kind of continue here on when we left in our opening session on this topic. But first, would you just tell, for people who might not have heard the first episode, why it is that you are teaching judges in your role as a teacher of judges? Why are you teaching them about mindfulness, and what does it mean for other people? Why should they care about judges' stress techniques?
Bev, I'm so happy that we're revisiting this. And one thing that I think you've said without even directly saying it, which is so important, is the fact that mindfulness techniques for judges who tend to operate inside of high stress, high anxiety, quick turnaround environments. And when I say quick turnaround, meaning they're often relied upon to make really important decisions, sometimes in very short windows of time. And under these conditions, they can experience levels of stress that they don't readily recognize. It can lead to mind wandering. It can lead to errors in judgment, quite frankly. And it is so important to equip these important decision makers, judges, with techniques to manage the environment that they often find themselves in. And not just the immediate courtroom environment, but these techniques can be used, what I like to say, both on and off the bench, because they are not specific necessarily to judges, although we do want judges to have the liberty and the ability to acknowledge the distress of their professional environment. But this is also the same for other individuals in similarly important roles. This can be anyone from, you know, the head of a company to the director of a department, or even, you know, someone in education and in other fields such as nursing or medicine. It really is what I like to call a transdisciplinary field of practice that can be applied across the board to just about anyone. But for judges in particular, what we found is that so many are now willing to acknowledge the challenges of their responsibilities and the necessity to make more thoughtful decisions that impact and affect the lives of others, but also allows them to be settled and comforted that they're doing the best job that they can and keeping at bay some of those other negative interactions that might allow them to not focus, appreciate, or even make the best decisions.
So you talked the other day about how mindfulness is a way of calming stress, because the stress is so much in our head. We may be hijacked by fear or worry or things like that, or we may have repetitive voices in our head dealing with certain situations. But mindfulness allows us to put aside all of that and just focus on what's happening right now and making right now very calm. And that can quickly remove stress. Is that a good summary of how it all works?
It is a perfect summary of how all of this works. And the reason why what you said is such a perfect summary, because again, this isn't just the experience of judges, but this can be the experience of just about any individual. Being able to kind of calm what we talked about was that lizard brain, that fight or flight, and really being present in the moment, responding to what's happening in the moment, and actually being a little more patient and thoughtful and deliberative about how we respond. And when you practice mindfulness techniques, it's not just how you're thinking per se. I like to believe that the whole body gets engaged. It is every part of the body that responds. Yes, with the mind perhaps being the most powerful tool, but when you're really practicing these techniques and you're working to lower the temperature in the room as a judge or to bring things into focus, it really does engage, or require, if you will, the whole body to get in the game and to be present in the moment. And that can involve a couple different techniques, but I think the results are very worth it.
Well, let's go through some of the specific techniques that I know. I pulled this particular list that I, you know, shared with you a few minutes ago. I pulled that from one of your classroom PowerPoint slides. We can use that, and maybe we'll come across some other things that we've done. I'm interested in the ones that you've done, but you want to walk us through that list of techniques that you actually use when you're teaching judges, and your sense of how it's working for them.
Absolutely. And what I preface it by saying is, as we know, and I think as you probably can appreciate, is that lists are never all-inclusive, right? As long as we continue to live and to breathe and discover new and innovative techniques and opportunities, we can add on to this and we can continue to build it. And it's also individual for the person. So what may work for one person may require a minor modification or even an all-out deletion for another. But I would suggest for someone who's just starting their mindfulness journey to not be disheartened or even overwhelmed by some of these suggestions, but take the ones that would work for you or that could seemingly fit easily into your current lifestyle and build upon those. For example, if you are a person of faith and you really do commit to a life of prayer and or meditation. Some people substitute just generalized meditation for prayer. I would suggest starting there, remembering that even a focused prayer or a focused meditation takes time. It takes time to kind of calm your whole body and to get into the rhythm of your own breathing and to really start either an incantation or just the repetition of certain words, even if you begin with simple thank yous or reflections. Those things can really, really help you to, again, begin a focus. And if you start with just a few minutes a day, you can always expand it to more, or you can expand it to more frequency, even if they're for short spurts of time. You can maybe call it mindfulness snacking, if you will, kind of doing short spurts of mindfulness exercises. Other exercises.
I just want to interrupt here a second and follow up on what you're saying a bit, because I was reading about the kind of the history of mindfulness in the American culture and how it developed from looking at what happened with meditation and trying to apply it to other people who were not necessarily going to meditate. I think what the doctors noticed who were studying this is that people who meditated did have a very low level of stress, and that was reflected in their heart and all kinds of things. And then when they were trying to figure out how can we take it, any religion away from meditation. And they ended up just having people use the numeral one and repeat one over and over again in the context of breathing, you know, breathing in, breathing out, but saying one. And I think what the research showed is that still was very good at reducing stress. But then if you used a word that had meaning for you, calm or peace or a religious word, if you added the content back in, that was even better. So the physical technique of kind of saying one word over and over again is powerful, and then having a meaningful word enhances it. Does that resonate with you?
It absolutely does, and you are so very correct, which is why I started with that, you know, well, it's not one word, but two words, thank you, which contextually certainly can have a religious or faith-based meaning behind it, but it can also be fairly generic in the sense that it can kind of help you focus on just those things that you're thankful for. And what I like to say for the phrase of thank you is that, again, for those who are deeply committed to their faith and practicing their faith, this really does provide sort of that religious context that can really help to elevate the benefits of mindfulness, especially when you're focusing on the word, the meaning that you've applied to it through your faith, and your breathing and your response to it. For those who would like to just think of all the things that they're thankful for, I promise you, just spending some time kind of going through your mind of the things that you are very grateful for, even if it's just recent gratitude, right? I'm grateful that I was able to help someone with their shopping cart the other day because they seemed to really be struggling because their arm was in a cast, or I'm really thankful that in light of everything that's going on, I have employment, or I have resources, or I'm able to provide for myself and sometimes even for others. I'm really thankful, or I don't wait until November to be thankful. I can be really thankful now that there's good weather on the horizon and I hear that spring is 11 days away. Those may seem like very, very mundane or pedestrian things, but it really can work wonders for a basic, very general mindfulness practice that can grow and blossom into something extraordinary.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. The simple phrase, thank you, brings up a lot of positivity. And the two words, that's a good number of words if you're doing it to your breast, you know, two words in and two words out. So that works. And thinking about gratitude is one of the best ways to lower your heart rate, to reduce the physical stress in your body. There's just something about the part of your brain that feels and connects with gratitude cannot be there at the same time of anxiety. So the anxiety just sort of automatically kind of fades away when you're focusing on gratitude, right?
You are absolutely correct. It's as if the two cannot coexist. And so once the focus on gratitude takes prominence in your mind and also, again, throughout your whole body, it can really resonate. What you'll notice is that those feelings of stress or tension or anxiety have nowhere else to abide in, or they can't coexist in that same space as you are now turning your focus all but exclusively to these things. And I think, Bev, you could probably speak to this more and even better about how all of this and these reactions all speak to and work well within that strategic triangle when you focus on the three keys to engagement. But I think that this is a beautiful segue into part of that, which I would hope we could talk a little bit more about. But this is, as you've just said, the inability for this positive, if you will, and this negative to kind of coexist in the human psyche at one time becomes very difficult, but it's also very gratifying for the person who commits to practicing it.
So, yeah, this is an interesting different way of using the strategic triangle. Let me tell you that it's a phrase I've used to over the years, and you're calling from the description in my more recent book, Find Your Happy at Work. And basically, the triangle is, if you look at history about leadership and work life and all of those kind of things, there are three themes, different words are used, but three themes really are important in having people engaged in a positive way in their work. And I, because I wanted them all to have the same first letter in the triangle, I called them purpose, people, and processes. But basically, the point is that research suggests that first, purpose, which could be a mission or your value system or the reason it's important for you to keep this job because you're putting your kid through college, whatever the purpose of you're doing the work. If you focus on that, that's a very positive thing in the context of what could be a stressful job. And focusing on the purpose can help you not only become interested again in the work, but it's very calming. The two others are people and process. People means anybody associated with your work in a positive way. It could be your colleagues. It could be the customers or clients you serve. It could be the people you're putting through college with the money you're making from the job. But the people connections to work really matter. And if you focus, if you think about, I really love my colleagues, again, you can't have the anxiety and that positivity at the same time. That'll remove some of the negativity that's blocking your ability to enjoy work. It'll also reduce your stress. And the final one, processes, is really about expertise or doing your craft or doing something that is work that you enjoy inherently. If you can focus on your craft, it can really help you to stop worrying and to focus on the right now. So kind of what I think of as doing the triangle, going through the things that matter in the context of work and the way work plays in your life, that's a meditative technique, or at least a mindfulness technique that causes you to kind of pause. I thank you for integrating that into the context of mindfulness.
And I would like to better integrate that even as I begin and I continue to teach judges, because I think that this triangle is so important as you walk through the different prongs of the triangle. I myself began to think about how in my next meditative session, I will be more careful to think of those three prongs. One of them in particular is the last one you were talking about, which is the process, the craft, the way of working. And if you are fortunate enough to find work that is so meaningful and provides you so much fulfillment, I think at some point you come to appreciate that it doesn't feel like work. You may hear people frequently say, I can't believe that I get paid to do this because either I love it so much or I have so much fun. And there are those who long for those types of opportunities and to feel that way. And what I encourage judges in particular to think of is the enormous social benefit that they bring to society by the work that they do. Yes, it presents challenges and it can often feel like it is such a heavy lift, but it also is extraordinarily rewarding work. It can be both life-changing for others and life-affirming for the judge, such that it doesn't have to feel like work, but rather service to others. Service to yourself. These are the things that can help fulfill what I like to call our life missions, or what you said when you talk about purpose. I thought about having a personal credo and how your purpose kind of fulfills that. So thank you for that. And I will look forward to integrating those tenets when talking to my colleagues about the importance of not just a triangle, but how they can also integrate it. Other things I talk to my colleagues about as they continue their mindfulness journey isn't just the actual practice of praying or that two-word meditation, but you can also do other things that, again, still help to build that mindfulness practice. It can feel like simple things, Bev, like starting a journal and being very transparent with yourself in your journal and committing some time to actually writing those feelings down. Those could include everything from either your experiences and purging and getting past those, or creating paths for yourself to resolve unresolved issues, to creating goals and designing how you want to achieve those goals, understanding that that may not be a perfect plan, but having some kind of plan and some kind of goal is extraordinarily healthy, both professionally and personally. Exercising, whether it's walking or yoga or a HIIT program or Pilates, these things actually help to release energy that may not always be positive and may be pent up, and it needs a physical exertion to escape in order for the body to begin to heal and to feel better, and also for the mind to recalibrate.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because I was just thinking as I listened to the two of us talk, we're very talky people, journalism and law and all of these things. We think talk can do everything. But at the beginning, at the very beginning of our conversation, you talked about how mindfulness can involve a body awareness. And I'm so glad that you mentioned exercise. But I like the also your description in your course about how to, if you put words aside and concentrate on relaxing your arms, noticing your arms, your shoulders, your neck, and just focusing on something physical without having to put words on it, that can really help, can't it?
Oh, it absolutely can. And it also takes away, particularly for judges, it takes away the requirement to to verbally label, identify, and to speak to something, but allows you to just be. Imagine sitting on the bench and you're ingesting a lot of information, and sometimes you have a physical manifestation to those experiences. Well, teaching judges to relax the shoulders, to flex the hands, and notice how the fingers are curling and how they're relaxing, to place your hands perhaps right in front of you and to, again, massage them or to reflex them, can really help to bring down the tension, even if you're in the middle of a hearing or if you're receiving information. And no one has to know that this is the practice that you're engaging. I have a colleague who is now a retired judge from a Native American tribal court. And he would say that he always had on the bench what he called a worry stone. And when his anxiety level would get just a bit uncomfortable, he would take the stone and he would merely rub it. And it was the act of rubbing the stone, feeling the smoothness of the stone on his fingers or on his hands, and focusing on that, that would actually help keep him from mind wandering and to bring his attention back to the task at hand.
Yeah, and the thing is focusing. That's sort of the essence of it. By focusing on something that's there right now, immediately, you can, that helps you to let go of all this other stuff, which is causing you to be so stressed. And for some people, having something, a thing or a sound, it can be very powerful at helping you let go of all of the words and focus on something that is wordless.
Indeed, something that is wordless, that, again, also I think has the ancillary benefit of perhaps helping you to ultimately articulate an idea or a thought that you may have otherwise struggled to do so, whether verbally or in writing. It's that act of removing yourself from the obligation to use words always, to just merely focusing and reformatting your attention or redirecting your attention so that you can return to your task and actually be very responsive to that.
When your mind is calm and you kind of let go of the worries and the stresses, it changes your brain in some way so that the creative parts of the brain and the connections across the parts of the brain, there's more of a kind of a flow. I'm sure I'm not saying it the way a doctor would, but my understanding is that by getting into a position of calm, you free up the unconscious to take over and help you make the decision and figure things out. So it's a wonderful factor of our magnificent brains. They can take care of us if we just relax sometimes and let them.
Indeed. And Bev, I'll even go just a little bit further and say you're absolutely right that this is kind of the way this fantastic organ of the body works. And I think we'll still spend another lifetime trying to figure out all of its intricacies. But what we've described here today, I think, are, you know, some of the beginning steps, or maybe even the short-term steps that someone could take to begin the mindfulness journey. For other judges that I teach, I like to recommend things that I think will help sustain them kind of throughout their careers and throughout their experiences on the bench, because no doubt, now what happens frequently is they take some of the experiences in the courtroom with them wherever they go, and it kind of follows them. And without proper tools in place, these things can be impactful. So I like to recommend that they do things that really do help to manage this long term and to focus on self. I often suggest what I like to call a 90-day rule. And the 90-day rule kind of suggests that every 90 days, which is four times a year, just every 3 months or so, that you literally disconnect from the challenges of your work. And even if that is only for a day or as long as several days, three or four or five, but to literally disconnect, to literally schedule it on your calendar, that you will not focus on work, you will not read it, you won't engage it, but that instead you completely immerse yourself in other things that help to feed and inspire your happiness, right? And so if that means taking a long weekend once every 3 months and committing to not responding to emails or text messages or thinking about briefs that need to be addressed or decisions that need to be made, but instead purposely identifying a place or an environment that brings you happiness. If it's a garden at home, if it's a book you've been intending to read, if it's a old friend that you've sought to reconnect with, or a loved one that you'd like to care for or to create a positive memory with, to give yourself the latitude, permission, and even responsibility to some degree to do that with on a regular schedule. And with a level of consistency that continues to feed those purposeful and intentional acts, making sure that they are just that, intentional, so that when you do return to your professional environment, some people call it refreshed. I'd like to say that you're more focused, and that you're more prepared, and that you can more mindfully respond to your responsibilities there. But you can only do that. I believe the human brain can only take but so much. And so
that's so true.
And purposely scheduling a disconnect so as to properly reconnect makes a world of difference.
So one of the aspects of what you're talking about is like a reboot. It's like indeed, you have to stop and then start everything up again, just like your computer. And if you do that regularly, four times a year, that's enough to stop you from getting in the rabbit hole where you are working day after day after day and you think you can't quit. If you structure a pause by putting it on your calendar and you're faithful to it, that seems like a pretty good cadence to keep you from really becoming totally overwhelmed. Is that kind of how it works?
Absolutely. That is absolutely the recommendation.
All right. Well, that is a great recommendation for us to end with. There's nothing like remembering the importance of taking breaks, short ones and longer ones, and doing it regularly to help us not be quite so stressed. And talking with you, Gail, always helps me to be not so stressed. We've come a long way on these issues. I think neither one of us started out understanding so much about mindfulness, but it has been helpful, hasn't it?
I absolutely agree. And I will tell you that the feeling is certainly mutual. I am frequently reminded by you the importance of self-care, and that self-care is not selfish. It is necessary for us to be our best selves and also to be available to others. So thank you for that beautiful and gentle reminder.
Well, thank you for being here. And thanks to all of our listeners for being here. I hope everybody has a great day. Today we've been talking with Judge Gail Williams-Byers about how to enhance your career by managing stress. This podcast is produced by WOUB Public Media. Adam Rich is our audio engineer. I'm your host, Beverly Jones, author of Find Your Happy at Work. And our sponsor is the Voinovich School of Leadership and Public Service at Ohio University. Today's tip is that there are many simple ways to reduce your workplace stress. And if you can move away from constantly being on edge, you'll be both happier and more productive. Thanks for listening to Jazzed About Work. Please come back soon.